once again for tuning into the Psychedelic Podcast. I'm your host, Tina Marie, here with Rob. Today's episode is all about addiction and recovery. So we have a very special guest we both find truly inspiring. Before we get started, we would like to share some statistics about substance abuse. Only 10% of Americans dealing with addiction receive treatment. That's a very low number.
That's astronomically low.
Especially considering they have statistics on how many heroin addicts, how many active cocaine users, and methamphetamine users. All of those numbers might be a little bit off because I don't know how they could collect these statistics properly.
All numbers are off. No statistical data is gonna be 100% accurate.
4% of American teens struggle with a form of substance use disorder. This doesn't surprise me. The number does. Children should not be around anything where they would be wanting to use substances, but unfortunately that's not the case, especially with the way things are right now.
Yeah, and with our culture of being predisposed to more and more money, violence, and drugs, that number is going to keep climbing and climbing, and that's unfortunate.
Another number I don't find completely accurate. 14.8% of young adults struggle with at least one form of substance use disorder. This makes more sense to me.
That's a significant number. It could be higher if we had a way to
really gauge that.
Completely accurately account for every single body in the United States.
Yeah, definitely.
Still a high number.
One in every 16 adults reported having a substance use disorder in 2017. That is an astronomical number. How many of them are not telling the truth? Because one of the problems with addiction is the lies that come with it.
Yeah, so that's the first step to recovery, is admitting that you are an addict. And that is, from what I've heard, the hardest thing to do. So I wonder how many more people should be a part of this statistic as well. One in every 16. I can't think of any other disease, mental illness, or cognitive malady that is a higher ratio than 1 to 16. I can't think of anything.
Meth is currently used by approximately 897,000 teens and adults in America, seriously contributing to the drug problem. Meth is basically just a bunch of random chemicals thrown together to create this monster of a drug that's really a serious problem. I feel like heroin and methamphetamine is on the same echelon when it comes to the amount of people affected, especially in lower income areas. And meth is a serious problem in the South, where we happen to live. So we see a lot of that happening out here.
I'm sure a lot of listeners here have seen Breaking Bad. They had to get rid of a guy who was after them in the cartel, I think. They used one of the buckets or vats of ingredients, which I think it was some sort of phosphorus, a red powdery chemical, and they would mix it with something and put it in a bucket. They dumped him into a tub and poured it onto him, and it made him melt through the floor, and it disintegrated his whole body. So that's one of the ingredients in meth, or compounds from the periodic table that's in meth.
Most of us know somebody who is struggling with addiction currently or has struggled. It's very commonplace today in our society, and it's very unfortunate since it isn't most people's fault. I actually knew a girl after high school who got involved with a meth ring in North Carolina, and half of her face was melted off as a result. I don't believe she's with us now. Approximately 5 million Americans regularly use cocaine. Big number.
Regularly, wow. Regularly doesn't mean you use it once a day. That's something that you're using every 30 minutes. For 5 million Americans to be doing that today blows my mind.
Regularly, it could be 3 to 4 times a week, is how I'm reading this stat.
It could be, yeah.
If you're using cocaine every 5 minutes every day, you're probably gonna not last too long on this planet, unfortunately. Probably even past 2 weeks if it's like that.
There's people that can do it for years and years and years, and if you're doing it 3 to 4 days a week, those other 3 to 4 days are gonna suck that you're not using it. So I don't think most people can flip-flop like that all the time.
Right. 10% of the people who misuse opioids become addicted to them. It says people who misuse opioids, but most people that use opioids were prescribed them in the first place by their doctor and might not even know that they're getting addicted to them until they realize when they don't have them anymore. At that point, they're just going to seek out anything they can find. The 10% of people that misuse, you're using it in the hospital. You're not misusing it. You're taking your appropriate dose, right?
Misuse to me means taking too much. It's highly addictive, so I don't see how certain people cannot get addicted to a certain amount.
But yeah, it's simply not true.
So when I see the word misuse, that leads me to believe that somebody is abusing their medication, in this case, opioids. A lot of the times, people who get addicted to opioids end up becoming addicted to heroin because it's so much cheaper. And this is from knowing and being around people growing up that have experienced these things. My friend in high school who got into a serious car accident, got hit by a drunk driver head on, snapped his fingers back all the way to his wrist, shattered a whole bunch of bones in his leg. Just a grotesque thing that happened to his body. He had to have this Hellraiser-like contraption, this big metal cylinder attached to his knee that had all these spikes coming out of him that would keep his leg elevated while he was recovering, and it'd be attached to the ceiling because he's in excruciating amounts of pain. So the doctor gave him Percocets. That's what they give you. That's where the opioid epidemic comes from. Comes from people being prescribed them. It wasn't his fault that he got addicted to them originally because he needed them. When he started to recover, he didn't need them so much for pain, and it was just making him feel high. He was already completely addicted to them, and they kept upping the dose. He got into heroin. A lot of people can't control these things because it's an instinctual part of their brain that takes over and becomes more important than eating, sleeping, all these other things that we need and desire. It becomes number one over all of those things. If somebody's introduced to something that's addicting and they had no choice in the matter, and it becomes their number one priority, you can't really fault them for that.
I feel like that's most people that get addicted to opioids, so that was a really sad story to hear. We're going to move on to what sober living homes are. Not many people are familiar with this, but in the communities where drugs are prevalent, I'm sure most people have heard of halfway houses or sober living homes. They are not synonymous. Halfway houses are way more structured. The sober living homes are structured in a way that avoids some of the limitations of halfway homes, because I believe you can't have cell phones, or most people that are in halfway homes are coming out of prison, and it gives them an opportunity to have a cheaper place to live while also attempting to stay off of drugs. In my opinion, the problem with this is they still have access to the drugs, and there's a lot of paperwork you have to sign at both of these types of environments. They're simply not doing the right things in other forms, because people are overdosing in these types of homes either way. They're not being watched the way they need to. They're lacking all of the sense of community, etc. The essential characteristics of a sober living home include an alcohol and drug-free living environment. They don't have formal treatment services because it's not a rehab, but they are definitely encouraged to attend self-help groups like AA or NA, comply with house rules, abstain from using. They have to pay their rent and fees and be a productive member of society.
And they don't really have guidance per se or counselors. They anoint a house leader and they keep each other in check. But obviously they're not perfect, and that's why they're there. Although they may be the most qualified candidate in the house, but they're still an addict. So that's a tough way to run a house for a place full of addicts. I don't think that really works. I don't think it's been working. It's been very profitable for these companies that house these people. They're just getting a lot of overturn and making a lot of money. For these addicts, it's not a long-term solution. From the people that I've known, it's never worked out for them, but for a short amount of time.
We've all heard these stories about people opening up sober living homes in Florida and other places like that, where they get tax breaks and a whole bunch of money just for having one. These are the types of places where people that we love and know are passing away while they are attempting to get better, meeting the wrong people in there, not having the correct resources, not having a sense of community, still feeling like an outcast, and that is another stigma that needs to be broken. Addicts are people too. I truly do not believe that in most cases it's their fault. They may be at fault for some of the things that they do in regards to not seeking treatment out faster, but maybe there's an underlying reason for that. I think trauma has a lot to do with that as well.
Definitely. And it isn't their fault a lot of the time. Most of them, they want to get better so, so bad. They just haven't made that step. When you're going through something like that, especially with this trauma that you can't paint a picture for somebody what you've been through and for them to be there exactly the way you need them to be there, it's hard. And that's what AA and NA does. That gives people that opportunity to do that, you know, as best as they can. And that works for a lot of people, and that's great. I mean, that's the best solution for addiction and alcoholism that I know of. I can't really think of anything else. A lot of people don't want to get better, but you never know if eventually they'll turn that corner and want to get better. That's why you can't give up on these people. That's why we can't give up on anybody with any mental illnesses, unless they're sick and sadistic and are doing horrific things to people in society. That's different.
And these are just our opinions. I just want everybody to know that. We are not psychologists or therapists by any means, nor are we people that fully understand statistics half of the time. Just know that if you see somebody in person or online and they look like they're struggling with addiction, rather than making fun of them or gossiping about them with your friends, maybe you should be that good helping hand to reach out and ask them if they need some kind of help or if they need somebody to talk to, because you might catch them at that moment where it gives them this feeling of gratitude and you change their entire life. So be that person.
And with all this in mind, let's get on over to the interview. This is Chase Hill, who started a company called Raider Recovery. He's one of my good friends from middle school and high school.
Chase is definitely doing a lot of good things in his community to help recovering addicts, and he has a program that he wants to start very different from the ones that we just spoke about with sober living homes. There are a lot of new components that he would like to add, and welcome, Chase. Evening.
I'm doing well. You know, all things considered, I could be better, but I could be worse.
That's a good answer. Rob, how about you?
I'm good. This is my friend Chase. We went to high school together. It's good to be talking to you 15 years later.
I don't know what made me think, you know, let me call Rob Trimpert and see what he thinks about this project. Definitely was a good phone call to make, it seems.
It was meant to be.
Chase, you've firsthand experienced the ripple effects of addiction, and you want to change the format of recovery homes. What does the word addiction mean to you?
Addiction is pain. I remember the pain of the last time I used and the suffering in those hours. You take the meanings of the words into yourself. I've gotten to a point to where that pain is a motivating factor, etched it on the inside of my skull, and that's what I've done with the word addiction.
How long were you in it, and how did you get out of it?
People go from your first use and on in NA. First time you used, and for me that was 13. there was this kid at school who I'm actually really, really close with now, Green, who was picking on me in seventh grade. We were supposed to go fight at Love Point Park one day. He never showed up, but I ran into these high school kids who were smoking weed and hanging out. I had tried marijuana for the first time then, and nothing really happened after that until I was about 15. Again, Green and I started hanging out. He had an uncle or a friend or somebody who started getting us weed, and it was just 15 to 17. It was pretty much just marijuana until I started with pain pills. I started experimenting with those, then ecstasy, then acid, then, you know, just a little bit of everything until I found my true love when I was like 20. I tried cocaine, fell in love with it. Wasn't even good cocaine. It was in Louisiana. Like, it was all stepped on and awful. When I got moved up here and got closer to New York, I started getting much better quality things, and my addiction really set in. And I was an IV cocaine user for quite some time then, until I went to jail. I had shot Green because he broke into my house while he was high. And he will tell you today, he's so glad he got shot. Like, that's what got him clean, was him breaking into my house and getting shot. He thinks it's a life-changing thing. You know, we talk every day almost. I relapsed and decided, you know what? I just got to go to rehab again. That's what I got to do. I need treatment. Just that sober time of being in jail wasn't enough. I need to follow it up with something.
Right.
This was my second attempt at rehab. My first was in Louisiana. And I did well for about a year until 2017. I started using again, IV using. What ended up happening was I realized I was spiraling. I went to rehab again. I got out. I started going to NA meetings. And there was this really, really pretty girl that I wanted to go hang out with. Don't 13 step at all. To get back on topic here, I went back to rehab. And then I went to NA. And I met this girl. And I went to a party. And I tried heroin for the first time in my life. And immediately overdosed and died.
Immediately. My God.
I don't even remember doing it. I remember mixing it up to do it. And I was treating it like it was cocaine, which was definitely a mistake. My toxicology came back. I didn't even fail a urine screen for heroin. There was no heroin in it. It was all fentanyl.
That is insane. So that's a big, big problem going on. And we have the pandemic, and we have this epidemic that's been ongoing for so long with addiction and everything. So would you say that what you've been through and the trauma that you probably have gotten from a lot of being in active addiction has contributed to your reasoning for wanting to start the Raider Recovery Project?
In the times that I relapsed and in the times that I had made those stumbles and falls, it was because, you know, I had essentially been ostracized and isolated due to the stigma of my addiction, the stigma of my mental illness. And when you separate someone from society, it's really hard to get back in. Today, I haven't used a needle or hard drugs over 3 years now. I think the reason for that is because I have stayed very socially connected. Like, I look for the next right thing to do. I have the Fellowship of NA. I have a Pokemon Go rating club that I participate in for no other reason than just to get the interaction. I feel like these social bridges I've built have become kind of like a barrier between me and my own addiction.
Right.
I realized that when I heard a guy on a TED talk about Rat Park. We're all familiar with the rat cage. So it gets a bottle of water, and then it gets a bottle of water with cocaine in it.
Universally, they just all get a cocaine bottle.
It could be heroin. Sometimes it's LSD. LSD had some really interesting effects on the rat. But the constant is the rat didn't have any choices.
Or friends.
The only thing the rat had to do was either A, drink water, B, live in a cage in isolation alone with, and you know, from a rat's point of view, I'm in here forever. How am I ever going to get out, you know? And three, get really high. So when those are your only options, and that's the meaning of your existence, because you have nothing else, of course it's going to get high. Of course that experiment yielded a 100% overdose rate. Every single rat died. Now, Bruce Alexander looked at this in the 70s, and he realized kind of the same things I'm talking about now. The rat had no choices. So he built Rat Park. And what Rat Park was heaven for rats. Tunnels, colored balls, cheese, friends, hamster wheels, everything a rat could need. And they put those water bottles on Rat Park. Not a single rat overdosed. Not a single rat exhibited compulsive use of the drug. Now, rats and people are really, really different. But I think that it speaks to the significance of the exercise to say we went from a 100% overdose rate to a 0% overdose rate. Why are we not trying to incorporate this philosophy into our own models?
What types of philosophies are you looking to implement into your program, Raider Recovery?
Instead of tunnels, we want to do work shuttles. Instead of colored balls, we want counselors on site. We want to consolidate a bunch of services that already exist into one ease of access location to eliminate the problems of the transitional individual.
Right. And of course, in crowdfunding for this, it's probably difficult to want to get people on board. But with the things that you have planned, a lot of it being virtual, I feel like people are going to be on board with this concept. So you've talked about to me before, virtual therapy and counseling could definitely be a part of this if we get enough funding for Raider Recovery and job opportunities and affordable housing. What else does Raider Recovery have to offer?
Well, first, I want to touch on what you mentioned. We're already seeing companies like that, that virtual counseling where you can text a counselor. Most people work 40 to 80 hours a week. People finding the time for counseling is tough. Being able to have that subscription to be able to participate not only with a counselor, but with like an actual group setting and group therapy, I think would be instrumental for a lot of people, like especially like the people who aren't in our program is what that's really geared for. What we're looking at for the job opportunities is I have a lady, Miss Claudia, Big Oak Farms in Harrisburg, or outside of Harrisburg, already agreed to provide employment for anybody who comes into our program. I have a business partnership with Eric Carter in Harrisburg, who is also willing to help however he can with the rapport there. We can work out some kind of work arrangement for people, something mutually beneficial for everybody. And as far as this virtual idea of fundraising, Mike Prodich from Red Sun Rising got back to me. He's really interested. I'm waiting to hear back from Epitaph Records. I even reached out to The Situation from Jersey Shore.
Yeah, and we're going to be doing an upcoming live stream where Chase is going to be speaking to everybody about when the actual virtual event is going to be. And we're going to be having a donation, a silent auction for art. There's going to be plenty of musicians performing during this virtual convention. I know you're also working on a in-person convention up there in the area that's going to be COVID-friendly.
And beyond that, using my connections and previous connections from the music world, I ended up getting contact with a buddy who works for Guitar Center. We're looking at potentially getting some donated used gear to auction, too. It's just a matter of whether or not they really want to get political. That's their thing right now, and I can't blame them for that.
Do you think there is a lot of hidden politics going on recognizing addiction and bringing the tangible resources to the table to help people?
I think the problem is, and you can get on Facebook and see this every day, the argument today happening is addiction's not a disease. It's a choice. It's, you know, and you got people who want to shame people and addiction shaming and mental illness shaming. But if you ask these people on a regular day, they'll say, oh, yeah, I support mental illness and recovery until symptoms come up. And when they see those symptoms, there's that stigma that comes with the symptoms. Although they're OK with you being in recovery, they're OK with it as long as they can't tell. The arguments being made right now against addicts has kind of gotten a little heated. So for a company to go, oh, yeah, we want to support Raider Recovery, or, oh, no, we don't want to support Raider Recovery, is creating kind of a lukewarm atmosphere in the corporate world because, like, they don't want to say no, but they don't want to say yes either because there's ramifications both ways. And my job is to let not only them know, but anybody watching now that this isn't about whether or not someone's made mistakes. We're going to openly admit that these people have made mistakes. I've made mistakes. People watching this have made mistakes, and they've repeated those mistakes sometimes. Like, it's not about the mistakes they made in the past. It's about how we can create productive members of society out of these people now.
Very, very true.
There's every other form of help in the world, but there's such a humongous wall of a stigma for addicts. And I feel like every other facet of the world, everything's been glorified. The only category that gets left out is substance abuse.
I agree with you. We need to take that mentality about this body image issue and, like, you know, Me Too and all this, like, it's okay to be proud of your abuse and proud of your mental illnesses and stuff. We need to take that mentality, right? And as far as the mental illness goes, we need to actually practice it because we're only saying we accept it now. Right. Everyone's okay with an autistic child until he has an episode. And then it's, oh, yeah, no. So if we can take that mentality of, like, looking at you know, large people who are confident in themselves, want to be beautiful and are being beautiful, and apply that to an addict who wants to be beautiful and wants to be productive and wants the same things everybody else wants. For me to open a recovery house, I have to actually go around in the community and get community approval.
Right.
You don't have to do that with any other institution.
That sounds like what they do to sex offenders.
Yes, that is exactly what they do to sex offenders. So like we're kind of treating them all the same. But like if you want to build, you know, again, like a church or a mosque or a synagogue or something for people to better themselves that way, that's fine. But if you want to build something to better themselves through this addiction and stuff, you have to combat the stigma. And that's the only way. And that's why raising awareness is so important, is because in order for us to get the wheels moving, we first have to defeat the stigma.
Right. And not naming any or bashing any recovery houses. I know everybody wants the best. This one is very different, everybody that's listening right now, because of the different opportunities that they have involved in this project. And there's a lot of room for growth with that too. And it's a nonprofit organization, so any kind of donation will help this. I see a lot of the types of houses that are meant for addicts to live in right after they get out of rehab. So many overdoses happening because they're not really being watched properly when they need that support. And if they don't like a 12-step program like the ones you attended, then they're not having that sense of community. And if they're not having it there, they can at least find it in their house. And when they don't find it in their house, there's no sense of community for them at all. And what do they say? Hungry, angry, lonely, tired.
I love what you're talking about with the current model, because the current model is broken, but we're not here to fix it. We're here to build a new one. The model works like this. It's essentially a glorified hotel. And because of that stigma I talked about, you have to get the community's acceptance. These recovery houses tend to pop up in bad neighborhoods, right next to crack houses. When you have a low supervision environment with no tools, it's just, okay, pay me $150 a week and you get a room and a bed. Good luck.
Right.
The entire time I stayed in a recovery house, I didn't get one drug test. Not one.
I did a lot of research on this. They only will drug test you if somebody else in the house is saying, I think this person's on drugs. That's the only time. And that's why you see a lot of deaths happening in those recovery homes. The lack of support, not following through with what's asked of them, or the papers that they sign at the very beginning are really vague and there's not much for them to do. So to have a recovery house with some amazing stuff happening on the side, like these job opportunities you're talking about, maybe a swimming pool, something like that would be great for them so that they could feel normal, because they are normal people. Most addicts have a story behind them as to why. It's not just, oh, one day I picked this up and became a drug addict. They usually have a really sad story behind why they did something. So that's why the stigma needs to be broken for them.
For me, it kind of ties back to domestic abuse. And I've been working through that, especially like through my fourth steps and stuff. My mom was really abusive. I'm sure Robert might remember a story in middle school where Josh came to school talking about how funny it was that my mom beat my ass.
I don't remember that, but it doesn't surprise me at all.
By the way,
my mom went out of her way to go to Josh, tell this story and make it as funny as possible so that he would go to school and tell it. Like, it's not Josh's fault. He's a 13-year-old kid hearing a funny story from my mom, you know? Like, I'm not blaming anybody, but like, that's the kind of growing up I had. My mom would come home drunk at 2 a.m., rip me out of the bed and beat me up. Whenever I found cocaine, I realized I didn't hurt anymore. And there's other ways we can get people to stop hurting.
Right.
And you talked about signing papers in a recovery house. My recovery house experience can be summed up in like a minute. I walked in. The guy cussed me out. He hand wrote on a piece of paper, no drugs, no bitches. That's what he wrote down. And he said, here, sign this and give me $125 and I'll show you to your room.
That's so messed up. That sounds like a really, really bad Motel 6 experience.
It's pretty much the same. There's a lot of social factors in Harrisburg that make it really ideal. We have the proximity to the business partnerships that we're able to pursue, as well as active work release program at DCP. DCP is relatively involved in the community. The state representatives and Governor Tom Wolf are there. Being able to communicate with them lately has been really well. I have a contact at the state representative's office, Mr. Oscar, who we've sent the business plans and stuff to, and he's trying to do what he can to get us some state funding.
I haven't been to Pennsylvania that many times, except for maybe Hershey Park.
It's 20 minutes from Hershey.
Oh, wow. Well, that puts things into perspective for me. That's cool. You could take some of the people that are in the recovery homes there.
That's actually been discussed because the social and communal connectivity is what we're pushing. We're talking about biannual trips to Hershey. We're talking about having a work program, keeping this super affordable, $150 a week max per person, making this a situation where not only can you get connected, but you also have the opportunity to save money. When you look at this on the grand scale and you realize that you're helping like a lot of people, that gives us a lot of budget to be able to hire more staff, to be able to do more things just from that rent revenue alone.
Have you lost any friends from drug use?
I've lost a lot of friends to overdose. I've lost people to going to prison for life, even though you can still kind of talk to them. That's pretty much like they're dead. And I have people that I loved very, very much to the point of almost physical pain that want nothing to do with me now because of drugs. And, you know, it's really hard to stop loving those people because you carry that for them. At a certain point, you also realize that you played a part in the dissolution of those relationships also.
Right.
Realizing that has actually helped me grow a lot. I do music so much. Coheed and Cambria said something in a Favor House Atlantic. They said, the loss of friends you didn't have. So I also have to look at it like, regardless of how much I love these people, the fact that they were willing to abandon me in those times of need and stuff means that they were just friends I didn't have.
Yeah. That's very true, because a true friend would have stuck around no matter what. And when you're doing all these big things and giving back to the community in the way that you are going to, from what I see, it's funny. Those are going to be the people that try to come around later. Yes. And they don't want to be there for you on the steps to that. And that's so unfortunate for them. And it's sad for you. But it's good that you know what you're trying to do is right and that you've got a new support system because you didn't need anybody that negative in your life anyways.
You did need them, though, because
to learn.
They're going to be the driving force to how you channel this thing into something positive. The second you get caught up on all the guilt and the shame and the regret and did I do this right or that right, you know, we should hold ourselves in juxtaposition to other people in the same manner. We should treat ourselves equally. So if we're so hard on ourselves to be like, what one little thing could I have helped them with, even though in the grand scheme of things, although we're self-loathing, we know deep down that ultimately it isn't as simple as it's our fault. You know, that's kind of selfish. So if we channel that into actually having self-compassion and self-love, all of those guilty thoughts are going to hinder you no matter what. Anything positive going forward is the only answer.
I think that's basically what Chase is doing.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not going to get into too much detail about it, but I think you touched on some great points there, and I want to elaborate on one or two of them. I lost the person I love most over drugs and the illusion of drugs and extra things. In doing so, I also lost a second person that I loved most. Losing those two people relatively recently has been really detrimental, but it's also brought me to a point where, you know what? I have to love me too. And if I don't love me, I can't love anybody else. The only way I can love myself every day is if I'm helping someone every day. And if I'm helping someone every day, then I'm living recovery every day. And if I'm living recovery every day, then this we're talking about the Raiders Recovery Project. And that's just all there is to it.
When you look at it that way and you actually translate it into your life, you go from scum of the earth, addict, worse than any other classification of people in the world, to somebody that could completely use all that darkness for light and have all these awakenings and understandings that you would never get if you didn't go through addiction in the first place. So you go in some ways from the worst type of person in other people's eyes.
Yeah.
But and then in my eyes to the best person that you can be.
It's funny you say that, use the darkness for light, because like today, and I want to touch on this too because of what I said earlier, my mom and I have a relationship today.
Good.
I sought that out and said, look, this mommy issue stuff and all this extra stuff is challenging me in my life. I am not going to get better unless we figure this out. I think we have, and we're in a good place now. She told me, if you could only figure out how to use your powers for good, I think you'd be unstoppable.
Oh, that's probably so beautiful to hear for you, especially after the traumas that you had to go through growing up with her.
And you know what? I wasn't an easy kid to love. Like, I had a lot of serious mental problems as a kid coming up. even though I was a child, my reactions and behaviors played a role in that also. Being able to mend that relationship and have that with my mom today has been instrumental in the fact of me being able to keep a needle out of my arm for the last 3 years.
Congratulations on 3 years.
Yeah, congratulations, man.
Chase, one more time for everybody out there. How can they donate to helping fund the Raider Recovery Project?
You're going to see a GoFundMe, but that's going to go away. We're essentially just going to set up a PayPal and a business account under the LLC of Raider Recovery. And I say LLC because I think it's important that we're private and we don't have anyone to answer to and we can make our own standards. Because when you have someone to answer to, they think they know better. We don't want a house that's like everything else the state does. To be different, we have to be private. And to be private, we have to apply for a business loan. The SBA has already insured my business plan, so I can take my business plan to any bank and have my requirements cut in half because the SBA says this is a solid business plan.
That's wonderful. And this is a nonprofit. Once again, for everybody that's listening, I do condone this project and I will be a part of it in my own ways that we will reveal at a later date. It was really a great conversation. Do you have any final questions and thoughts?
That's good that we got to have this sort of structured, but non-scripted, realistic talk about it. But without just in a room full of people and you knowing that it's important and it's going to reach people's hearts.
And, like while we're talking about just being unscripted, to address the addict now that still suffers, I'm talking to somebody watching right now who's wondering where they're going to get their next one at. You don't have to live that way anymore. It's not that serious. People do love you. You're going to lose that. I've lost it. I've lost myself. And there's pieces of me I still haven't found. And maybe I don't need to find.
Yeah.
But I am here for you. Chase Hill, even if it's not Raider Recovery, even if Raider Recovery never happens, Chase Hill's phone is on. Call Chase Hill. We will figure this out.
And I'll leave a link to Chase's Facebook and the Raider Recovery Project's Facebook in the description. So, Chase, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to speak with us about this. I know it's a tough subject to talk about, but we could tell you're very passionate about this. And the Psychedelic Podcast condones this 100,000%.
I never thought I'd be doing an interview about recovery and a project. It's just happy coincidences. And that's why I think that this is what we're supposed to do. Crazy coincidences have been coming up. Finding you guys, getting my hands on a program director, the pieces falling into place, the guy at Northwest that hooked me up with the SBA, the Small Business Development Center in Clarion. Everything has been falling into place too perfectly for us to not succeed.
Yeah.
So our next step is the fundraiser.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely.
And then when you're sober and you're clear-headed and you see amazing positive things happening in your life, you don't think that they're too good to be true because if you have the introspection, you can see that those thoughts are going to lead to it not working out. So you're contributing to that when you have that self-doubt.
Negative and mindset. But
yeah,
he doesn't have that.
That's which you, which you don't
prophecy.
Have.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. No. Raider Recovery will exist. I think realistically, if we can get a successful fundraiser going within the next 2 years, we'll be seeing construction.
Yeah,
definitely. Thanks, Chase. Looking forward to seeing what you do with this project. Very exciting. You have a good night.
You too, guys. Enjoy.
All right. See you, Chase.